case of the day, United States versus Jones and others, 10-3130. And Mr. Eberhardt.
Please the court, Mr. Chobet, counsel. Mr. Jones raises two claims before your honors, the first being whether or not the Fair Sentencing Act should apply and whether or not the failure of the district court judge to apply the Fair Sentencing Act resulted in an unconstitutional sentencing disparity between he and some of the other co-defendants. With regard to claim one, obviously we all know where we are at in the state of the law in the Seventh Circuit. Even the government in this brief has suggested that the FSA should apply. I don't know if the court's aware, so I will let the court know that in a case out of the Seventh Circuit, Corey Hill versus United States, it's a Supreme Court number 115721, it's set to be conferenced on November 7th of this year, and the Solicitor General, rather than filing a brief in opposition, actually filed a brief in support of the Supreme Court granting certiorari in that case. So the court may consider wanting to keep tabs on that case and maybe just stay a decision in this case because of the FSA question, see if the Supreme Court makes some kind of determination. With regard to issue number two, in the government's brief at page 22, they talk about how, now quote, co-defendants Masuka and Mason were not similarly situated. Masuka and Mason cooperated with the government and Jones did not. This is just simply absolutely wrong. In the probation officer's pre-sentence report, it's noted how Mr. Jones sat down with the government, proffered, told them everything he knew about the case and actually put himself or created greater culpability for himself. Mr. Jones actually freely discussed with the probation officer in preparation of the pre-sentence report information that the government was not aware with regard to this case. But the problem with Mr. Jones's information was he was not a co-conspirator. Out of all these 28 defendants charged, he and one other person were only charged in a substantive count, so Mr. Jones could not give the government information about other co-conspirators. He could not provide cooperation at this big overall trial that was going to be planned. He could not point the finger at other people. He could not make a deal, so to speak, with the government that apparently made them happy enough to give him the third offer, to give him the 50% off that they do normally, or I shouldn't say normally, they do in a lot of cases. So going to Mr. Masuka, the government's documents talk about he was the main runner in this drug trafficking organization, responsible for 70 kilos of crack cocaine, involved in the running of guns and money, and he makes a deal for 171 months. Mr. Jones, who was charged with one transaction but gave up information on himself and others, received 180 months. Your Honors, there's some cases that the law is hard to find where it's going to fall, but the results just turn out wrong. This individual involved in one transaction compared with the main operator under the head of the organization getting 3 months more in the penitentiary is just wrong. Now, with apologies to Mr. Chobet, who will be up here shortly, he has a client who received 48 months on a phone count. He went to trial. There was a mistrial. And what I'll suggest the government did as a matter of convenience, instead of wanting to try this case all over again and go into it, they returned a superseding indictment, let him plead for 48 months on a phone count. And in the government's brief at page 8, footnote 2, they talk about the transactions that Mr. Germany was involved in, six other crack cocaine transactions. So again, I get to the point where there's some cases where something has to be done where there's got to be checks and balances on the government, either in the way they charge it, in the way that they draft and come through with their plea agreements, but it's just simply wrong. I suggest to your honors that the district court made the wrong decision in not applying the FSA, and because of that, not going down to that 5-year mandatory minimum and giving Mr. Jones some benefit at his sentencing that other individuals who were very much more involved in the situation did. So simply, obviously, I ask the court to reverse and send it back.
All right. Thank you.
And Mr. Schobot.
May it please the court, I represent Deshaun Germany today. Mr. Germany was sentenced by Judge Zagel based on a violation of his due process rights. Judge Zagel plainly stated that he believed that my client had been convicted of numerous other offenses of which he was not convicted. At the time that Mr. Germany committed the offense that he pled guilty to and was being sentenced for, he had not been convicted of any offenses other than two minor traffic offenses, driving without an insurance, for which he received zero criminal history points. He did have a number of arrests for other with other charges, some quite serious, all of which were either
shot in two different incidents.
Yeah, he was actually not even charged with respect to his having been shot, but there was evidence that he had been a victim of shooting. The judge said that he wasn't considering that. He thought it was strange that someone could be shot twice, but he wasn't considering that. He expressly said, I'm putting that aside. Mm-hmm. But what he did not put aside were all of these other arrests, some for battery, one, in fact, for murder, all of which Mr.
Is it Germany, your position that Judge Zagel thought those were convictions?
He didn't treat them as convictions, but he believed and said so, that he believed that Mr. Germany had done the things that he had been charged with, that, in fact, he had battered individuals, that he had possessed and sold drugs on prior occasions, based on simply the arrests. There was no evidence adduced.
You left off the Indiana conviction in the accumulation.
Subsequent to his offense, in this case, he was convicted. But the judge didn't rely on that, because he expressly said, the reason I'm giving you the maximum I can possibly give you on the law, under the law, is because when you committed the offenses in this case, you didn't think that you were going to actually go to prison because essentially you had skated on the earlier cases. The Indiana case, he did not skate on. In fact, it wasn't an earlier case. It was a later case. It occurred later in time.
Doesn't the fact that he picked up that case while he was on bond for this case support the judge's conclusion? While you're on bond, you go commit another crime, you think you're going to skate?
No, because, in fact, the way that this case was resolved was he was not even going to resolve the Indiana case until this case had been resolved. Unfortunately, in this case, instead of getting an outright acquittal, which in my judgment he should have gotten, there was a hung jury, and the jury couldn't reach a conclusion. And so we had to make a determination as to which case could be resolved first. Ultimately, he did resolve the Indiana case first, which resulted in him having criminal history points here, but that was done in an effort to secure what we thought was a fair and reasonable sentence. And the clear point is that the judge relied on inaccurate information.
Well, the judge could rely on even arrest information if there's enough in the record to give him a factual basis to conclude that
the prior. If the judge had taken evidence on that and had seen evidence or examined some evidence and said, you know, I believe that you did commit this offense, that is something we would have absolutely challenged him on because, in our knowledge, he hadn't committed any of those offenses. But the judge took no evidence on with respect to those.
Did he object to any of the information about those prior arrests?
We didn't file any objection to arrests, Your Honor, because arrests count for nothing in terms of sentencing guideline calculations. He didn't receive a single point.
But the information about the circumstances that led to the arrest is something, if reliable and if there's sufficient information there, the judge could rely on it in determining his criminal history.
If we had believed that the judge was going to rely on the arrest history as an indication that he had committed those offenses, that he actually had engaged in that conduct, we absolutely would have challenged that. The
Judge Zagel say those things, that sort of talking about reality. He knew of the various police departments. He knew that sometimes things go away. Very fortunately for a person, this guy had a whole string of pretty serious things go away.
Right. And Judge, as a factual matter, it cannot possibly be true, because in three of those cases there was no leniency by prosecutors. There was no leniency by law enforcement officers. In fact, Mr. Germany had to go to trial and was acquitted on three of those. So the supposition that the judge made that, well, these were just prosecutors going leniently on him was absolutely false.
Well, in terms of other relevant conduct, I'm a little troubled by the record because the government came in prepared to establish some of the transactions that were the subject of the trial. They had the wiretaps, they referenced it, and you sort of waved them off saying, no, we all agree it's 48 months. There's really no need for that. And the judge accepted that invitation, saying, yes, I heard it all. But couldn't that also be he heard all that evidence? He could have a view of it. There was sufficient proof in the record for him to form a conclusion on that?
No, Judge. He expressly did not decide that issue. And the reason is that there would be no sense for the judge to conduct a two-day hearing in which we would have called witnesses and cross-examined witnesses. And at the end of that two-day hearing, no matter which way the judge went, the guidelines would have been 48 months. So, I mean, you know, what's the point of conducting a two-day hearing if it has no effect on the sentencing guideline range? And that would have been the result. If he had agreed with me, in whole, it would have been 48 months. If he had agreed with the government, in whole, it would have been 48 months. If he had agreed with me in part and with the government in part, it would have been 48 months. I don't think that this court should impose on defense counsel the obligation to challenge things that have absolutely no bearing on the guidelines, especially now that they're merely advisory, that might be permissible in the days when they were mandatory, but now they're simply a guideline to the judge. So why would courts conduct such hearings when, in the end, it has no impact on the guidelines? Now, we didn't agree with the government, and obviously that was what the trial was about, and obviously half of the jurors didn't believe that the government had proved it.
Half?
We learned from the judge that the jury was divided 6-6. Now, so at least half the jurors didn't think they'd proved it. The other half thought that they had proved it. So we recognize there's a different standard of proof at sentencing, but ultimately the judge didn't reach any factual finding with respect to those. And he gave the ultimate sentence he could give. Not only did he give the maximum, 48 months, he made it consecutive with the Indiana case.
But isn't that going to happen as a matter of fact anyway, because Indiana law would require them to run consecutively as a matter of law?
It might have happened, Judge, if the Indiana case had come second. In other words, if the government had not agreed to allow him to resolve the Indiana case first, there would not have been a plea in the federal case. We would have gone to trial. So we specifically agreed to have the Indiana case go first because under federal law, the judge could have imposed concurrent time. But you're right, Your Honor. Had the sequence been reversed, the Indiana court would have had to impose consecutive time to the federal case. And so We weren't going to allow that. We would have gone to trial in the federal case, and if he had been convicted, well, then that would have happened. But
all right. Thank you.
We don't think he would have been convicted. Thanks.
All right, Mr. Garcia.
May it please the Court. Anthony Garcia on behalf of the United States. And I'll address the issues that the defendant Jones and defendant Germany addressed and rely on our brief with regard to the Federal Sentencing Act. With regards to Patrick Jones, the issue that was raised in this was a disparity argument regarding his sentence as opposed to co-defendants Kevin Masuka and co-defendant Shamika Jones. With regards to Mr. Jones' arguments about that Mr. Jones was not a cooperator, with regards to the government's definition of a cooperator, an individual who gave substantial assistance in the government investigation. And that's what Mr. Masuka and that's what Ms. Shamika Jones did in this matter. And that is not what Mr. Patrick Jones did in this matter. Mr. Masuka was the primary cooperator in this case for the government. In addition, he continued to give ongoing, truthful and ongoing cooperation. And so did Ms. Shamika Mason. Both gave truthful and ongoing cooperation, and Mr. Masuka was the government's primary cooperator in this investigation. Mr. Jones did not provide that type of substantial assistance to the government's investigation. When looking at the sentencing guidelines and the recommended sentencing for Mr. Jones, he received a great deal of benefit in his sentence. He received a sentence of 180 months, 82 months lower than the recommended sentencing guidelines in this case. His sentencing guidelines was 262 to 327 months. A substantial reduction. He received relevant conduct in the probation in the PSR, and the total grams that he was attributed to was 623 grams of narcotics in this matter. And he was a career offender. He received a substantial benefit during his sentencing. With regards to Mr. Germany, during sentencing, the district court did not solely rely on the arrest record as presented by Germany in his argument and in his brief. To take a look at the Germany issue, we must take a step back in order to look at the whole case as a whole. Specifically, defendant Germany was charged in a superseding indictment with conspiracy and two counts of using a telephone to commit a drug trafficking offense and one count of a possession with intent to distribute. He was released on bond on June 5, 2008, and while he was out on bond, starting on February 11, 2009, he started to sell rock-like substances in Indiana, crack cocaine, and not just on one occasion, but on five separate occasions. After that, he was arrested in March 2009 in Superior in Lake County, Indiana. At that time, he went to trial in April 2010 in the instant case. At the conclusion of the trial in federal court, there was a mistrial. The jury was hung on this matter. What's more importantly is Mr. Germany's defense during that case was that this was a mistaken identity. He was not the individual on the telephone. He was not the person who participated in the substantive drug count. However, he does plead guilty on September 3rd, 2010 to one of the phone counts. Then at that time, he decides, no, it was me on that phone, in order to accept a plea with a maximum statutory sentence of 48 months. I believe that that's what the district court was referencing during sentencing, that what he finds troubling about with the defendant in this matter. At first, it's not him. He's out on bond. He continues to commit additional acts of selling narcotics, and then he pleads guilty to an account. During sentencing, the government was prepared to provide the evidence for the district court for relevant conduct, but the district court concluded that the district court had sat through the trial, had listened to the evidence, and accepted the PSR's recommendation. The PSR's recommendation included the relevant conduct and the conduct that was provided at trial. The probation officer went as far to say that the evidence provided at trial was beyond preponderance of the evidence to provide relevant conduct of 280 grams of crack cocaine for sentencing. The relevant sentencing guidelines were 135 to 168 months, and the district court accepted those recommended sentencing guidelines. Those were the sentencing guidelines that the district court applied in this matter and made reference to that there was no way that the district court could fathom a sentence that would be less than twice the maximum statutory sentence according to the recommended sentencing guidelines that the district court was accepting. So what we're looking at is the defendant getting a substantial benefit in this matter. He was receiving a maximum statutory sentence of 48 months, when in actuality, had he gone to trial, and the district court did make a comment about this, how the defendant did gain a benefit by what happened during the jury trial, that he was gaining a great benefit by only being able to receive the maximum statutory sentence in this matter, and that's what the district court gave him. The district court gave the defendant the maximum statutory sentence of 48 months, not for the arrest, as the defendant currently argues, but for 288 grams of relevant conduct, an additional five distributions of selling of crack cocaine while he was out on bond, and not accepting responsibility by going to trial in this matter. And that is what eventually resulted in his 48-month sentence. By the time sentencing comes around, it's not a matter of what sentence he's getting. It's a matter of whether it's going to be concurrent or consecutive to the sentence in Indiana. And the district court in this matter concluded to sentence the defendant 48 months consecutive to the sentence in Indiana.
Counsel, could you address the argument made by Mr. Jones that it was error for the court not to specifically discuss the disparity, the national disparity for this particular type of offense, that his sentence was excessive under that calculus?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court did address that issue. However, in somewhat of a passive type of address during sentencing, in the defendant's sentencing memorandum, the defendant does explicitly lay out the sentencing disparity in this matter. The probation officer did not adopt that matter. However, the court did have to take that into consideration and chose to adopt what was recommended by the PSR. In that fact, the district court found that the disparity was not applicable to this defendant. The relevant conduct, the conduct in the sales in Indiana, and what the evidence that the district court heard at jury trial came to the conclusion that this defendant deserved a sentence of 48 months and was receiving a great deal of benefit for the crime that he did commit. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, we would ask...
There don't appear to be.
Thank you, Your Honor. That we would ask for the district court to affirm the sentence for Mr. Jones and affirm the sentence for Mr. Germany.
Thank you. Does Mr. Eberhardt have any time left? Okay. Mr. Eberhardt, do you have anything else?
I'll leave 30 seconds. Give 30 seconds.
All right.
30 seconds to show that. Just one comment, Your Honors. As I see the government standing up here, they sit here and they say, well, Mr. Jones, he just wasn't a good enough cooperator. But I would like the court to consider that sends a very dangerous message to the criminal milieu or these gangs and whatnot that are out on the street. You know, we stand in these courtrooms. Your Honors sit in these courtrooms. Maybe sometimes the agents need to come in here. But what I suggest and what I submit to this court is happening is with the government's attitude, those criminals are going out there saying, you know what? Instead of getting out of crime, instead of not being involved in this, if we're going to be gangbangers and we're going to be involved in drugs and guns and money, we better do it good.
Fortunately, criminals don't pay much attention to what we say.
I'll pass it along, though, Judge. I mean, we do talk to the people in the MCC. We do have contact outside, and the government lawyers have contact outside. And I submit to the court that these gangbangers are out there saying, you know, if you're going to do it, you may as well do it good, because then if you get caught by the government, you better have something to give them to get your sentence down below the poor guy who committed a one-time offense. Thank you.
Mr. Chobot, I'm sorry that 30 seconds didn't get to you, but we do have the appreciation of the court, both you and Mr. Eberhardt, for accepting appointment in these cases and advocating vigorously for your clients. Thank you. We'll take this case under advisement as well as the others.